Welcome to the program. I'm Richard Brendan. Journeys Fire Radio is celebrating its 18th year here on 88.7 FM WICR. It has indeed been an honor for me and a labor of love to be on this station that long interviewing some of the most inspiring people in the world. I want to thank the original general manager, Ed Rayling, for giving me that open door opportunity. I want to thank the current general manager, Scott Eakers, for allowing me to continue to stay at this station. And I want to thank also Russ Maloney and Joe Bainline, two guys who still mean the world to me, and they were on staff for a good part of that time when I was here. I'm going to play two interviews today, an hour of inspiration for you. The first interview, I'm going to play a dear friend of mine, Heidi Fletterjohn, a great talent here in Indianapolis. She wanted an opportunity to have conversation with John O'Donohue, and she was totally digging his book at that time, Beauty, the Invisible Embrace. So without further ado, here is Heidi's conversation with the late, great John O'Donohue. From WICR at the University of Indianapolis, I'm Richard Brendan with Journeys Fire.
Good morning and welcome to Journeys Fire, a voice for soul and service. This is Heidi Fletterjohn sitting in for Richard Brennan. Today we'll be speaking with John O'Donohue. John is a PhD, an Irish poet, an author, and a Catholic scholar whose writings reveal an original thinker rooted in an orthodox blend of Irish heritage, German philosophy, and Western theology. A gifted and engaging author and speaker, John lectures and leads seminars throughout the United States and Europe, encouraging his audience to become artists of their own deepest possibilities. John has written a myriad of things, and through the glow of image and narrative and a deft underpinning of thought, John's writings draw the reader into an intimate conversation with neglected or unknown regions of the soul. Readers say his work puts words on things they have felt for years but never found a way to express. His work seeks to be on the threshold where the hunger of our contemporary questions might awaken the treasure wells of our traditions. Currently, John's working on a postdoctoral dissertation on the 13th century mystic and philosopher Meister Eckhart. He's also got a myriad of beautiful books, one that will be coming out in February called To Bless the Space Between Us. It's a book of blessings for all seasons and occasions. John's joining us today from his home in Ireland. Let's bring him on. Well, welcome, John, from across the seas.
Thank you very much, Heidi. It's lovely to be on the show with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. I wanted to ask you about beauty. Your work is amazing in all its forms that I'm aware of, but I'm especially moved by your work on beauty and wanted to share that with our audience today. Tell me, in my limited understanding, the word beauty has taken on some containment in our language, some cultural containment, and sort of narrowed in its use. How would you define beauty?
Well, I think beauty has to do with shape, sound, presence, elegance, surprise, transcendence, and emotion. And I think that our times are probably the most visually aggressive time in human history. From every screen and every corner, our senses are assaulted by a relentless kind of stream of images. And for that reason, I think it's very difficult in our times to get space and to have the patience and time that's required in order to really engage with beauty. Because I think there's a fatal equivalence in our time whereby beauty is reduced to glamour. I think our times are full of glamour, and glamour is all about the outside image. You look at People magazine, Hello magazine, all these airbrushed images of faces, and if you look at them, actually it's very interesting always, I find, because the eyes are inevitably so hungry, because there's nothing that an airbrush can do for a hungry soul. So you have all this glamour, but it's ultimately tinsel, and it's all foreground and has no background. Whereas I believe that true beauty has depth and substance to it. And I don't think that beauty is a luxury. I think that beauty is vitally necessary for the soul. And I think part of what kind of prevents us from healing the violence that often happens in kind of culture and suburban areas is the ugliness of the architecture and the awful mediocrity of the containment structures for humans. I think that the human heart needs beauty, and I think that actually it's surprising. I often think this about the poor, who have very little, that in a way they're lucky because their hearts are not oversaturated with so much falsity. And I think actually that one of the real ironies of our times is that the rich get so lost and the poor always know where they are. That's not to glamorize poverty, because it's terrible and it's unjust and it shouldn't be happening. There's a lovely sentence from Kathleen Rain, whom I met once and who was one of the great English poets, a wonderful woman. And she said, "Strangest of all is the ease with which the vision is lost. Consciousness contracts. We forget over and over again until recollection is stirred by some icon of that beauty. Then we remember and wonder why we ever forgot." And I think that beauty is natural to us. I think from the moment that we're born, that our eyes are trained on the face of the mother. And that's ironically, when I was researching the book, I discovered that's where we get our first inkling of beauty, is in the symmetry of the human face. And always afterwards in our experience, something that has symmetry and proportion and order seems to satisfy something in us. I mean, that's the wonder of music, because music somehow implicates us in a harmony that we don't have to control or manufacture. The other thing I'd say about beauty is that beauty and spirituality are rarely mentioned in our times. Our times are very hungry spiritually, and everyone's after spirituality, and people who would have got a heart attack if the word spiritual had crossed their lips 10 years ago now can drop the word spiritual at least 5 times in 5 minutes. And an awful lot of the spiritual writing and spiritual programs and that are quite empty and incredibly banal, because spirituality has lost touch with the depth of tradition. And I think that one of the sadnesses of religion is that religion has concerned itself more with the ballast of morality and moralistic thinking, and it has forgotten the flame of beauty which lies at the heart of every religion. And an awful lot of fundamentalism, particularly in the States, is very ugly because it's manufactured coherence, and it's not something that emerges from the flame and fire and light of beauty.
And so would you define that flame as beauty, or is beauty a product of that place, that energy?
I think that beauty, one of the remarkable things about beauty is how autonomous it is. It will not be manipulated or controlled by us. And in some strange way, it's only actually when we're ready that beauty will decide to visit us. There's a lovely passage in one of Rilke's letters when he talks about at night when the forest is all stilled and everyone's gone, that the great beasts come to the water to drink. And that's the way that beauty visits. I mean, it's amazing, I think, how nourishing beauty is for all of us. I mean, I know people who hold out on front lines of what is humane and what keeps us all humane, fighting for justice, and they wouldn't be able to do it were they not in touch with beauty. And there's a film that I saw one time called, it has got, oh no, I'll be able to remember the name of it, Shawshank Redemption.
Mm-hmm.
I'll start that sentence again. There's a film I saw one time called The Shawshank Redemption, and it's a film about the awful violence of prison life. Morgan Freeman is in it, and Tim
yes.
Robbins. And Tim Robbins one day manages to get in. He's working in the library in the prison, and he manages to put on a record. It's something from Mozart. And he locks the door and puts it on the loudspeakers. And suddenly the beauty of Mozart's music is played all over this prison. And then when you hear that, you suddenly realize that every sound you've heard in the film up to that point has been completely ugly. And then the beauty reveals the awfulness of what's happening to all of these people. And I think it was Pascal who said, in difficult times, we should always keep something beautiful in our hearts. Because I think an awful lot of the spirituality that we're now encountering and a lot of the how to do books and self-help books are all little manuals for kind of turning yourself into a little kind of successful spiritual kind of projectile. Whereas I think that the beauty of beauty, if I'm not being totally tautologist, is that you can't control it, but that it actually raises your dignity, awakens your elegance, and restores your sense of rhythm. And I think if you have these, I mean, I always think that dignity is one of the most underestimated presences in the human life, really, and elegance as well. And I think if you have elegance and dignity and hold your head up, you can move through any difficulty.
You talk about the origins of the word the beautiful in Greek.
That's right. The word for beauty in Greek is ta kalon. But kalon is also related to the verb kalain, which means to call. So in my book on beauty, I have suggested that there is such a thing as the call of beauty. About 2 years ago, a friend of mine in Manhattan, who's a big business person, phoned me up and said that she was going through a kind of spiritual crisis. And she said, I don't really want to go and do therapy and all the rest of it, but I want to kind of I want to return to some kind of balance. She said, give me some simple suggestion. I said, okay, here's a very simple suggestion. I said, try each evening to take time to watch twilight.
Oh.
And try to get up each morning to watch the dawn.
Hmm.
And just return to that elemental rhythm of sureness. And just watch what happens to your mind over 2 or 3 weeks. And it completely brought her back to a sense of proportion and belonging and ease.
Hmm. John, you, as we spoke about in the introduction, are a poet and a writer and a lecturer.
Well, I inflict a poem on you.
Yeah, would you?
I would love to. There's a poem I wrote years ago called Bannock, which is a poem of blessing. Humans have ripped it off everywhere, but I wrote it for my mother, Josie. So it's a poem of blessing, and there's one Gaelic word in it, which is Curragh, which is a canoe. So I'll read this for all of our listeners, that it may bless them this evening. Bannock. On the day when the weight deadens on your shoulders and you stumble, may the clay dance to balance you. And when your eyes freeze behind the grey window and the ghost of loss gets into you, may a flock of colours, indigo, red, green, and azure blue, come to awaken in you a meadow of delight. When the canvas frays and the curragh of thought and a stain of ocean blackens beneath you, may there come across the waters a path of yellow moonlight to bring you safely home. May the nourishment of the earth be yours. May the clarity of light be yours. May the fluency of the ocean be yours. May the protection of the ancestors be yours. And so may a slow wind work these words of love around you, an invisible cloak to mind your life.
I know silence is just a curse on the radio, but I don't know what to say.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. Tell our listeners where they might be able to read this.
They can read it in my book, Anam Cara. It's at the beginning of it. And I have a new book coming out in the springtime, in the land of the free and the home of the very brave. And it's coming out from Random House, and it's going to be called To Bless the Space Between Us, a book of blessings for all kinds of different occasions, for morning, for evening, before, after meals, for a traveler, for friends on the arrival of illness, for conflict and love, for the breakup of a relationship, for new beginnings, for callings, homecomings, desires, and I'm going to include it in that book as well.
Wonderful. John, when I think of Ireland, I think of a land of storytellers and poets, and we've just been blessed with you telling us a poem. How did you become interested in beauty? Is it woven into the soup?
I was born in the Burn in County Clare, which is this amazing limestone landscape where all the shapes of the stones are different and where the light catches them and reminds you that they were once at the floor of the ocean. and the proportions of the landscape, the way that light plays on it, the beauty of the flora, is just, it's an amazing place of immense mystical beauty and bordering right on the ocean. So I always thought that the ocean was an incredible goddess, and her kind of beautiful restlessness was all around us. So that's how it was always in my mind. And then I've always loved beauty. I love beauty in spirit. I love it in language. I love the beauty of kindness and compassion. And I also love beauty of spirit in humans. I think it's amazing. But the landscape is an amazing thing. Each year in May, I do a 10-day tour in the west of Ireland where humans come and we live together for 10 days and have lectures and talks and that. But I always take them out into the landscape because I think that the engagement with the landscape is both a poultice for the mind and the heart and takes out the toxic bits from us, absorbs them. But it also restores us to rhythm with our native stillness that is within us. And I love beauty in language, like I love poetry and I love, you know, good words. I think my father used to always say when we were children, he'd be telling us, like, the importance of friends. He'd say, show me your friends and I'll show you who you are. And I used to always kind of re-paraphrase that for myself in terms of language and, you know, say, show me your words and I'll show you who you are.
I know that many women that I know, including my dearest friends and myself also, tend to put the word beauty, as you spoke of earlier, with the glamour and with a sense of perfection. But you talk about the flaws as being critical to beauty. Can you tell our listeners about that?
Yes, Sylvia Plath, the wonderful poet, said, I hate perfection. It is barren and cannot have children. And I think perfection is an awful imposition, because usually what passes for perfection is judgmental standards that become a kind of an imperative and squeeze people and make them feel guilty and miserable.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there is a time in one's life when one comes to see the beauty of one's own flawedness. That doesn't mean that one deifies one's weaknesses and limitations, but one's helplessness. I mean, I always find it's impossible to trust somebody who seems to be perfect. It's just too one-sided.
Mm-hmm.
But when I can see a person's flaw, it always evokes in me a sense of balance and compassion. And I know that I can trust that person because I know that weakness and vulnerability is not alien to them, but somehow they have found peace with it. It's interesting when I was, it took me 3 years to write this book, and I read about, I suppose, 120 books to kind of season my mind to write it. But one of the things I read was Japanese theories of beauty. And it seems that in some domain of Japanese aesthetics, that actually a thing is not considered beautiful unless it has some flaw. And I always think that that's like the sign of individuality, you know, that like it's not everything alike, but you're distinguished by your gifts, but also by your flaws. Nietzsche, the great philosopher whom I love, said that one of the best days in his life was the day that he rebaptized all his bad qualities as his really most brilliant qualities.
Well, that's something that we can, good repetition for me to recall.
Yeah.
The gifts that are inside of those imperfections.
That's right, because I think that there is no option, actually, Heidi, because I think the other, the alternative is to view one's flaws and weakness as something that must be banished, eradicated, and cut out. And Jung has shown us very clearly in his theory of the return of the repressed that if you kick all your bad bits out the front door, no sooner will you have closed the front door that they'll all be knocking at the back door to get back in again. So that in actual fact, the only pathway to transformation and transfiguration is to befriend that which is most difficult within you and let it enter into its own conversation, and then you bring more and more of yourself home. I mean, I always think that that's one of the ways of describing the human journey. It's like to try and become parent to everything within you and to make a hearth and a home where it all can find repose.
We've spoken about getting ready for beauty, preparing ourselves. And Are there words you could give us about being engaged with beauty, being a vessel to take in beauty, and then also being able to spill it?
I think it's very simple, actually, because I think that openness to nature, I think everyone should have a place in nature that's very special to them and unique to them. I think everyone needs that as much as they need a bedroom and a house and a place to rest. Mm-hmm. Rilke, the great German poet, whom I love, said, "In difficult times, you should always endeavor to stay close to one simple thing in nature." And I think that's so wise. I know this woman who has a lot of trouble with her mind, and her mind goes now and again. And she has this big stone in her apartment. And I said, "Why have you that stone there?" And she said, "When my mind begins to go," she said, "I focus on the stone." And then she said so beautifully, "You know, there's huge sanity in a stone." That's one thing. I also think that it's very interesting. You know, I do a lot of talks in the Land of the Free and the Home of the Brave. And I've started asking people now in groups where I do, when I talk, is when is the last time that you had a great conversation? And I think that's a really good question, you know, a conversation that sings in your mind for days and weeks afterwards, where you feel seen and met and invited beyond your own prison walls that you've set for yourself. So I think, you know, I think like people fly to concerts or they go to see gurus, but I think they should reconsider and try and go to somebody that they could have a great conversation with. Secondly, I think it's awful important to ask yourself, what are you reading? Like, are you reading thrash? Are you reading something that is genuinely elevating your spirit and bringing you to places maybe where you'd rather not go, but where you actually need to go? I also think it's very interesting to ask yourself what kind of music you listen to, what kind of music you never listen to, and to try to enlarge and refine your tastes, because we need music as much as we need food. And the third thing I'd say is, like, because we all have laptops now and DVD players and everything, what kind of films do you watch? Like, I think everyone should be, you know, if you're interested in this world, I mean, if you're not, pointless suggesting this, but people who are interested in beauty should be acquainted with the films of Tarkovsky, the Russian director, Kieslowski, the Polish director, and I mean there's incredible French cinema now all over the place, these wonderful filmmakers show us worlds that really awaken the unknown side of our heart. Because I think one of the tragedies in Western society, and particularly in America, is that everything is reduced to a kind of psychotherapy model. And that's the language in which people now test their authenticity and their sincerity. Now, it's a valuable language in a certain way, but it's not and should not be the only language. The lovely thing about the language of beauty is that it never measures you, but it always invites you. And, you know, it always reminds me, I'm working on a paper now that I'm giving at the weekend in Oxford on Meister Eckhart, the 14th century mystic. Mm-hmm. And he said one time so beautifully that there is a place in the soul that neither time nor flesh nor anything created ever touches. So that means that your identity is deeper than your biography, because in America, identity is always reduced to biography. What's your story? What's happened to you? But what I'm suggesting is that there's a deeper dimension within each of us that is mystery. So that there's a place in you that nobody has ever damaged, has ever reached, and where you are not belittled or diminished. And I think one of the really great spiritual duties of a human being is to imagine yourself worthily, with your own complexity, but also with your own profound elegance and beauty.
What place does imagination take?
Well, I think imagination is the key to everything, you know. I mean, I think it's one of the most neglected human faculties. And there is this myth that only poets and artistic-y people have imagination, and
the rest
of people don't have it. I think they do, for two reasons. I think each one of us is a next baby, and when we lived in baby childhood world, we were all brilliant imaginers. We imagined what was behind the wall, what was up in the attic, what would come in the night, da, da, da. We lived in an imaginary world. And secondly, even though we're adults now, each of us at night when we dream are supreme imaginative artists. And we create narratives of dream with figures and places and landscapes in them that are absolutely powerful. So everyone is an imaginer. And I think that if you look at good film, read good poetry and fiction, go to galleries, see good paintings, have good conversations, and also have time for solitude, silence, and stillness, then that you come into your own imaginative depth. And I also think that it's fascinating. Like, the thing that I do is writing. And I mean, it's amazing to wait before the white page and see what the silence will deliver to you and what's hidden within you that you never suspected. I mean, there are amazing things hidden in people. And people, it's all that I always find cities amazing, like, because I live in the wilderness here. And for instance, today now, I only saw one person, which is the postman. And that's the way most days when I live here. Then when I'm out in the world, there are humans all around everywhere. But when I go to a city and see all these thousands of human eyes all going full blast everywhere, I often say to myself that they're all kind of like, they seem so often to me like they're evicted, that they're outside themselves, and that the whole tendency of our culture is to draw us out. Whereas in actual fact, if we slipped inwards into a bit of stillness, silence, and solitude, we'd be absolutely delighted with what we discover. Because I think at the heart of the human is this whole creative, imaginative birth, that we give birth to ourselves. Plato, the great philosopher, said in the Symposium that one of the greatest privileges of a human being is to become midwife to the birth of the soul in another person. And maybe on that note now, I might read this poem called The Nativity. I wrote 15 sonnets on the mysteries of the Catholic Rosary, and this is the one on Nativity, which is about birth and femininity and about the depth within us. The Nativity. No man reaches where the moon touches a woman. Even the moon leaves her when she opens deeper into the ripple in her womb that encircles dark to become flesh and bone. Someone is coming ashore inside her. A face deciphers itself from water, and she curves around the gathering wave, opening to offer the life it craves. In a corner stall of pilgrim strangers, she falls and heaves, holding a tide of tears. A red wire of pain feeds through every vein until night unweaves and the child reaches dawn. Outside each other now, she sees him first, flesh of her flesh, her dreamt son, safe on earth.
Why did you choose that poem for us today?
Because I think that it's a poem that has to do with beauty, mm-hmm. and it also has to do with that constant inner birthing where something new is always emerging. Mm-hmm. And usually the new thing emerges where you're on the edge and where it's difficult. A friend of mine who's a professor of psychiatry in Harvard, Helen Reese, was telling me that recently she saw Shakespeare's play The Tempest, and that it suddenly struck her that there had to be the huge tempest before identity clarified. And I think that's true for all of us.
Mm-hmm. What is the line, the red wire of pain?
A red wire of pain feeds through mm-hmm. every vein. It's about the pain of labor, you know. Mm-hmm. I remember I read that poem in New Zealand. I was on a book tour in New Zealand. And these two beautiful women came up to me afterwards and totally confronted me and said, you could not have written that poem. A man could not have written that poem. I did really. They said, you couldn't know that. I said, it's amazing with the imagination where you get.
That's right. More evidence there to your previous comment that that's so much is beneath us when we stand in front of the open studio,
right.
or the open page, or the instrument
so
in our hands.
Within us as well, when we stand or sit or lie with reverence in front of or beside each other. Like, I mean, I think that we radically underestimate the sublime and infinite depth of each other. Because life is so fast, like, it's all, everyone's stressed, everyone's racing, people then have quality time to which they come into like a Ferrari engine roaring, like, and you say to yourself, that's quality time? Jesus.
John O'Donohue, thank you for spending some quality time with us.
Well, it's really lovely. If any of our victims want more of this now, I have a website. I mean, I never thought I'd say this, but I have a website which is www.johnodonohue.com, and they'll find out different kinds of information there. And Heidi, thank you for a lovely conversation.
And now here's my interview with the great Maya Angelou. She was coming to Indianapolis at the time at Butler University as part of their diverse, distinguished lecture series. I also had a chance to meet her before she spoke. Dr. Angelou, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be on and with the program.
First of all, I'd like to congratulate you on receiving the Letarian Award. It's a National Book Award for your famous book, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. What an achievement and long overdue.
Thank you very much. actually, the award is for lifetime achievement.
It's
all the books, some 31 books.
There you go.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. You know, your writing is so deeply touching to so many, and you've said that when you write poetry, you do it to become closer to all.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, can you share more about this experience for you of being closer to all?
Well, I believe God is all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And each time I do anything, I mean, some things seem to have more immediate impact than others, but each time I cook dinner for someone, I want to do it at the top of my level, the best I can possibly do. I believe that the Creator has put each of us on earth to do the best we can do. Whatever it is, digging ditches or being a lawyer, or having a radio show, and writing books and or speaking. I just think that the better I can do, or the best I can do,
mm-hmm.
will put me closer to what all wants me to do.
Mm. I would love to hear about your discovery of the Unity Church and how that impacted your spirituality. Could you briefly share a little bit about that?
Yes, I had discovered the church through a man who became my mentor,
mm-hmm.
Frederick Wilkerson. He was a voice teacher, a voice clinician, he was called.
Mm-hmm.
He could help people who had trouble with their voices to repair the voice.
Mm-hmm.
And he was wonderful, and he introduced me to Unity, and I enjoyed the church. And then I went away from the States. I went to Europe with Porgy and Bess as their first black... I was really the premier dancers, and I sang the role Ruby, Sporting Life's girlfriend. I left my son for almost a year, and I was so filled with guilt. It was just terrible. When I finally was able to get home, my son hardly spoke to me.
Hmm.
Oh, it was terrible. So I went to a place in San Francisco then called Langley Porter Psychiatric Clinic.
Mm-hmm.
And the receptionist asked if I had an appointment. I said no. She said she couldn't see me. There was no one to see me. So I said, someone must help because I'm about to hurt myself and maybe another person. So she called around and told me to go to a certain office. I went to the office, and there was a young white man just looking so spiffy, button-down shirt and all of this and a good suit. And he said, asked me, what's the matter? And I couldn't tell him. I didn't know how I would say to him what it felt like to be the mother of a black boy,
mm-hmm.
growing up in a racist society.
Mm-hmm.
And how guilty I felt about leaving him. So he asked me two or three times, and finally I walked out of the office. I thanked him and walked out of the office. And I went to Wilkie, the voice teacher. So I told him, I'm going crazy. He asked me, what's the matter? I said, no, I'm going crazy. He said, no, I mean, what is the real matter? I really became angry. He said, here, sit down, take this yellow pad, and write your blessings.
Hmm.
And I thought, I said, that's not what I wanted. He said, just write that you could hear me say, write.
Mm-hmm.
And think of all the people in the world who can't hear their baby's cry, can't hear the murmur of a lover in their ear. Think of that. And he said, now write that you could hold this pad, the yellow pad, and have this pen. Think of all the people who are crippled and can't hold even a yellow pad or a book.
Mm-hmm.
Now write down that you can see, and then write down that you can taste. Mr. Brennan, he continues to list for me some of the things that I had taken for granted.
Yes.
And finally, when I came to write down that God loves me,
mm-hmm.
and I said, God, God loves me. And when I finally let it sink into my psyche, not just into my ears, I thought, God, this element, this creativity, this it who made fleas and flies and mountains and rivers and trees loves me, me, Maya Angelou. Goodness gracious. It still brings me to almost to tears, and maybe two tears, without any apology, that I am lovable to the extent that it all loves me. Then there's nothing I can't do, nothing good that I can't attempt to do.
Yes.
And from that day to this, I've never complained about anything. I might report, but I don't complain. This year I'm celebrating my 85th year on the planet.
Oh.
And I like the statement made by Art Linkletter. He said, growing old is not for sissies. So I agree with that. But I don't complain.
Yes. Yes.
If I have a choice, I'd rather grow old than whatever the choice is.
In the 85 years, you have learned a lot. And I loved what you said on Super Soul Sunday about love, what it is, your definition of it, or at least what it empowers. Could you share your thoughts now of what you're learning about this beautiful power of love?
Love is, if you claim it, it's there for all of us. No matter what stroke of bad luck we think seem to be going through, love is there and waiting for us to take it, to admit it, to allow it to be in our lives. And you know, I know that we are told that we should be peacemakers. I agree, and I think we should be peace bringers. I think we should have peace when we leave our house before even we arrive at a place where it's warlike or bellicose. And so I think that all of that is God. And it allows me to have the nerve to develop courage and to look at another human being who may have a different complexion than I have. And her hair may be different, and he may eat different foods prepared in different ways. But I know that I am a human being, and nothing human can be alien to me. When I know that, I know that I have enough courage to treat every human being with respect and appreciation and kindness and courtesy. Yes.
Let's talk for a moment about your most recent book, bestseller, Mom and Me and Mom. Released this year, this book talks about your relationship with your mother. You know, from a very early age, you were sent to live with your grandmother. Can you briefly recount the experience, the emotions you felt as you took the ride across the country to live with your grandmother?
I was 3 and my brother 5.
Oh.
And my mother and father agreed to disagree. And it was probably the best thing that could have happened to my country that they at least gave us to my father's mother and didn't continue. They might have imploded on my country. And so it was the best thing that could have happened to me. My grandmother loved me, my father's mother. And she never once kissed me. I stayed with her 10 years. I don't remember her ever once kissing me. But she would call me when she had visitors. She'd call me out into the room where she was. And she'd say, now, sister, pull up your sleeve. And I'd pull up my sleeve, and she'd hold my arm and then ask, have you ever seen an arm straighter than this? Look at this arm, straight as a plank. And look at it, smooth and pretty, brown, as smooth and brown as peanut butter. And that was equivalent to being set in her lap and rocked.
Oh.
I mean, you know, she loved me and had the patience to care for my for some of my ailments.
Mm-hmm.
Because I, at one time, from the time I was 7 until I was 13, I didn't speak to anyone except my brother.
Hmm.
I had been molested when I was 7, and I told the name of the criminal to my brother, who told it to my family, mm-hmm. my mother's family.
Mm-hmm.
And the man was put in jail for one day, released, and a few days later he was found dead.
Mm.
And the police came to my mother's house and said the man, it seemed, he had been kicked to death. Mr. Brennan, that was in my hearing. And I thought my voice had killed a man. So it would be better for everybody if I didn't speak. Because I might just kill people. My voice could kill people.
Sure.
That was my 7-year-old logic. It was an amazing punishment I put on myself. And after I'd been with my mother's people about 3 or 4 months, after a while, they wearied at the presence of this sullen, silent child. So they sent me back to my grandma in Stamps, Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
And this woman who had gone to the 3rd grade in school, who was the daughter of a former slave, owned the only black-owned store in the town of Stamps during the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd braid my hair the way old black ladies still braid girls' hair. I'd sit on the floor on a pillow, and she'd sit down on a chair. And my hair was huge and very curly. And she said, Sister Mama, don't care. These people call you a moron. You call you an idiot. Mama don't care what they say. And they holler all these words at you, don't.
Sure.
It hurts your feelings. I don't care. Mama don't care.
Mm-hmm.
Mama know when you and the good Lord get ready, you're going to be a teacher.
Mm.
You're going to teach all over this world. I used to sit there and think, this poor ignorant woman, doesn't she know? I would never speak.
My.
I had now, my office sent me over a list of the honorary doctorates I've received.
Uh-huh.
I have 71, and I've taught in Rome at the Rome Opera House, in Tel Aviv at the Habima Theater, and I'm Reynolds Professor at Wake Forest University,
mm-hmm.
and it's a lifetime appointment.
Mm-hmm.
Just amazing.
You've come a long way from
a
little
long
girl.
Way from this sullen, silent child.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, sir. In Stamps, Arkansas.
Yeah.
A town about as big as your studio.
You know, you also say that your mother was a terrible parent of young children, but
yes.
a great parent of young adults.
That's true. You know, I think people blame themselves when they are bad parents, that is, careless parents
mm-hmm.
with children.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother said, and I had to ask her not to say that, because it still hurt just to hear her.
Sure.
She said I was about 2 or 3 years old, and I had asked for something, and she didn't give it to me. And I hit her on the leg. And she said without thinking, she backhanded me right off the porch into the dirt. And she said when she looked at me in the dirt, and realized what she had done, she said, I don't have it. I don't have it to be a mother.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't have that. And that's for that, I'm sure, helped in their my mother and father breaking up
mm-hmm.
and them sending me to my grandma.
Yes.
So, but as a parent of a young adult from the time I was 14,
mm-hmm.
she was incredible. She understood me. She had patience, and I could recite things to her because I was starting to talk. and she'd ask me to recite statements like Rudyard Kipling's If, mm-hmm. and some of the poetry of Paul Laurence Dunbar.
Mm-hmm.
And she was so proud, and she made me smile. She'd say, oh, come and let the mother see you smile. Come on, come on. And she would, and I would smile. She'd say, look at my baby. Her mother's baby has a beautiful smile. It was so, she won me.
Yeah.
Won my heart.
Yes. In the book, you recount the experience of reconciling with your mother after having lived with your grandmother. Can you tell us how you felt when you and your mother finally reconciled?
Oh, I was so relieved.
Mm-hmm.
I was relieved because she called me darling,
oh.
and she called me baby, and I was just sweet. And I hadn't been called any of those things. And I resisted it because it was so new to me. You're like tasting something that looks strange,
mm-hmm.
and was never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
But finally, I had to agree that she loved me, and that she was a good woman, because she was very pretty,
mm-hmm.
and she had money. She owned a hotel, and pool halls,
mm-hmm.
and she had so. She was young, she was had health, and yet she never laughed at anybody. I mean, you know how some people, as soon as a person, a crippled person or a person who's hungry or poor, walks out of the room, people, if they don't say something rude, they make a face and shake their hands and, you know, like, what a shame.
Yes.
My mother never did that.
Oh.
And I admired that in her. When I was pregnant at 16, just graduating from high school,
mm-hmm.
and unmarried,
mm-hmm.
I told her, I got it told to her, and she asked me, do you know who the father is? I said, of course. I only had sex once. And she asked me, do you love him? I said, no. She asked, does he love you? I said, no. She said, very good. Then we're going to have no point in ruining three lives. We're going to have a beautiful baby. She's all of that.
That's beautiful.
Really?
Yeah.
And she loved him.
Yes.
And loved me. And she told me once, you can take your baby. I said I was leaving her house.
Mm-hmm.
But when you cross my doorstep, remember you've already been raised. You know the difference between right and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Do right.
Mm-hmm.
And know this, you can always come home.
Mm.
And many times I did go home, mm. bringing my baby and trailing whatever few pieces of furniture we had. And my mother was, you'd think that it was Christmas or something.
Mm-hmm.
She'd call her friends and say, hey, you can't guess what? The baby's at home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, don't come right now. I'm going to be with her for a few hours. Let me have her to myself. But then you can come tonight and have dinner. Yes.
Oh.
Oh, she was excellent.
Oh. We've talked about your experience as a child. How about your experience as a mother? Do you have any memories that stand out?
Oh, yes. My son, the best thing that ever happened to me in my life was the birth of my son.
Mm.
And having the responsibility to raise him.
Mm-hmm.
I told him when he was about 7 or 8 or 9, all through those years, that he had a place inside him that must be kept clean,
mm-hmm.
pristine. Nobody, no wife or husband, no child, no priest or rabbi or pastor,
mm-hmm.
nobody had the right to enter that place,
mm-hmm.
because it may be the place you go to meet God when you die.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let anybody misuse that.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him also that I would tell him what to do. And if he didn't agree, he could talk to me and try to talk me out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But if he didn't convince me, I had the last word. And so I married it a few times. And my then husbands would say to my son, I want you in by 10. And my son would ask, why? And the man was, because I said so, uh-oh. And so they couldn't understand how trying to raise this black boy, I had to give him some rights.
Sure.
And but in the end, I did spank him when he was about 7.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd gone into my purse and taken some chewing gum. I asked, where did you get that? He said, in your purse. So I told him, you know you're not supposed to go into my purse. You know that. Why did you do it? He said, I wanted it. So I gave him a spanking. And when I finished, he said, I said, I hope you never do that again. He said, so do I. So I said, after I've given you a seeing to, you still have lip? He said, I hope you never hit me again. Do you realize how big you are? I'm only 7 years old. So I told him, all right. I promise you I'll never hit you again.
Yeah.
And I never did.
Aww.
I said, but on the other hand, you will have to convince me and explain to me why you're going against something I've asked you not to do.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time he was 10, because every time he'd do something, I'd save up until he wanted to go someplace.
Hmm.
And I'd just sit down, please, and explain to me why you did what you did last month, last week.
Mm-hmm.
His mom, they're waiting for me. Our team is going to play. No, I'm sorry. Please explain to me. And so finally, by the time he was 10, he asked me, why don't you give me a spanking like other kids? And let me go to... No. So, of course, I had to raise him, and that was the only way I had. And he said, he's told this many times. People ask him, how did it feel growing up in Maya Angelou's shadow? He said, in her shadow. I was raised in her light.
Oh.
She seemed to see me all the time. I got very uncomfortable.
You have so many quotes I love, but one of my favorites is, a bird doesn't sing because it has an answer. It sings because it has a song.
That's right.
Can you talk about the importance of singing your song, of expressing your soul, your voice to the world?
Well, the truth is, nobody can beat being you but you.
Yeah.
And it's pitiful when you see people trying to imitate other people.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is, they have their own way of being in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And if it is said that no snowflake is alike, I don't know who has managed and measured all the snowflakes, but I know that no human being is exactly alike. We come here alone. And we may have the blessing to fall in love with someone,
mm-hmm.
or have some family member with whom one feels so close. But the truth is, you can't be as close as a person is to herself,
mm-hmm.
to himself.
Mm-hmm.
So you have something to say, some gift to give the world. You're here for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that the Creator ever lost any of its creativity. So I have a role to play. I have something I'm supposed to do. I believe that.
You speak all over the country at so many different universities, inspiring graduating classes as they prepare to go out into the world. And I think this is such a pivotal time for young adults, and you give so many inspiring words of advice for their journey. Can you tell us one of your favorite pieces of advice about life?
Yes, I really got this from James Baldwin.
Uh-huh.
And the statement is, you've already been paid for.
Oh, I love that.
And I love it. And I say whether your ancestors came from Eastern Europe,
mm-hmm.
trying to escape the pogroms, the little and large murders,
mm-hmm.
if they came from Ireland trying to escape the potato blight, which assailed not only Ireland, but the area which was to become Germany, and it was also assailed by the potato blight.
Mm-hmm.
If the ancestors came from Asia in the 1850s to build this country, to build the railroads, unable legally to bring their mates or spouses,
mm-hmm.
or to even own property in the land they were helping to develop, building the roads and the railroads. And if the ancestors came from South America, from the islands, and if indeed the ancestors came from Africa unwillingly, lying spoon fashion in the filthy hatches of slave ships, and in each other's excrement and urine and menstrual flow, they have paid for each of us already.
Mm.
And Jimmy Baldwin said that, then I took it as far as I could take it with that idea, realizing that all I really had to do was prepare myself so I could pay for someone else who was yet to come.
Oh, beautiful. Your presence and your words have inspired millions all around the world. I'm curious, who or what inspires you these days?
Love it inspires me. Love between a man and a woman, a man and a man, a woman and a woman, an adult and a child.
Mm-hmm.
A child, yes, love inspires me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can be inspired by a country song, or a song of Ray Charles.
Mm-hmm.
I can be inspired by the poetry of Eugene Redmond and Amiri Baraka and Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Nikki Giovanni. Yes.
Yes.
I can be inspired.
Beautiful.
By Sylvia Plath.
And speaking of university appearances, I know you'll be here in Indianapolis at Butler University next week on September 25th. We're really looking forward to having you here.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm looking forward to being there. You have a great poet living in Indianapolis, Marie Evans.
Yes.
One of the great poets in English.
Oh.
I love her work.
Well, you've honored us for being on today's program. Thank you so much, Dr. Angelou, for the work that you're doing in the world and the light that you're shining.
Thank you. Will you please come backstage and say hello to me?
I will do that, ma'am.
I would love that.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
In closing, here's one of my favorite Maya Angelou quotes. I've learned that no matter what happens or how bad it seems today, life does go on, and it will be better tomorrow. I've learned that you can tell a lot about a person by the way he, she handles these three things: a rainy day, lost luggage, and tangled Christmas tree lights. I've learned that regardless of your relationship with your parents, you'll miss them when they're gone from your life. I've learned that making a living is not the same thing as making a life. I've learned that life sometimes gives you a second chance. I've learned that you shouldn't go through life with a catcher's mitt on both hands. You need to be able to throw something back. I've learned that whenever I decide something with an open heart, I usually make the right decision. I've learned that even when I have pains, I don't have to be one. I've learned that every day you should reach out and touch someone. People love a warm hug or just a friendly pat on the back. I've learned that I still have a lot to learn. And I've learned that people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. Thank you so much for joining us today. I also want to thank my engineer, Aaron Duvall, and a special thank you to Angel Richardson, who has been my program coordinator for quite a few years right now. You've been listening to Journey Spire, bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.